Good evening, everyone. Welcome to this week's edition of Through the Keyhole. I'm your host, Karen Dolan, coming to you live from Rochester, New York, and it is good to be back. We've been off for a couple of weeks. What with the holidays, the New Year, Christmas, you guys don't listen over the holidays anyway, so we took the time off. I've got a lot of brand new shows lined up, ready for the next few weeks. I'm really looking forward to it. And tonight, I'm doing something that we were trying to do before the holidays, and this also just kept getting pushed off. But once again, I'm back with Rich Dolan, my handsome husband, and Peter Robbins, who is also quite handsome, I might say, Peter. Couple of UFO researchers. We get together once every month or so and talk about current events, whatever projects we've all got going on, what's new in our lives, what's new in the world of ufology. And we always have a blast, and I hope you guys have fun with us, too. As always, I want to hear from my listeners. If you're listening live tonight, join us on the message board to discuss the program and add your questions and comments. If you want to ask any questions during the show, please, please do. We certainly welcome that. Go to paranormalradionetwork.org and join us in the virtual auditorium where you can participate through instant messaging. You can email me with your questions and comments at kdolan@rochester.rr.com, or you can call into the show toll-free at 1-877-786-0562. And right now you're listening to Through the Keyhole on UPRN 105.3 in New Orleans. And welcome, Rich and Peter.
Hello.
Good to be back with you guys.
It is so nice to talk with you again.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, I get to talk to Rich all the time.
Yeah, pretty much.
We haven't talked in about 15 minutes, I think. It's been a little while. Yes. So here we are.
You're two remarkable kids?
Yes. Kids, thank you.
Well, they're the real adults, I know that, but...
Yeah, well...
We have our little... It's like a little coffee clutch that we have every month.
Yeah, but it's been a while.
Chat. It has been. I think we missed...
In fact, I was thinking we haven't spoken since before, on the radio, that is, since before the election.
Yeah, I think October...
Oh, really?
Mid-October was the last...
That's
season.
Correct, and we had to push back our November show, and then, of course, we took a month off last month, so doubly good to be back to you on the air.
Yeah.
Great to talk to you again, Peter.
Mm.
Now, I know everybody, all three of us, probably have a lot of really cool projects going on right now.
Indeed. In fact, as I recall, two of us have a project that we're working on together with others.
Mm-hmm.
Oh, yes.
Yes. And
yeah,
I spoke to our illustrious producer, John, and asked him what we were free to discuss on the air, because this is a project in development, and as a result,
we
have to, it's kind of close to the vest. And he said, you know, use your common sense, but we can talk around it a bit without giving absolute particulars away.
Can we say that you and I and another a very prominent ufologist are working on a treatment for a television show?
We are. That we
okay. Can't
definitely
say that.
Right. Well, if I may, Peter,
you may.
Stanton Friedman and myself are the currently the three primary investigators for a hopefully what will be a proposed television show. Kind of a neat UFO investigatory show.
And, right, we can't give you the exact format, but it's extremely original and a real reality show for a change.
Well, what I like about it, because the three of us have seen the treatment that is being presented now that will be shown out to the various networks.
Indeed, and there'll be an even more refined treatment next week that I'll be shopping in New York within the next.
What we have is a really, I have to tell you, I mean, even if I weren't involved, I would just be looking at this thinking the production values on this show are outstanding.
I was thinking the same thing.
Yeah, a very neat idea for a UFO investigative type of television show. What makes it amazing is we've got three knowledgeable people in front of the camera doing this, but also there's some outstanding technical talent behind us.
Holy moly, do we have...
Really, I think can do some fabulous work and bring to life a lot of the cases that we're going to be looking into in a way that I don't think has ever happened on a television show before.
I think you're right. I think it has some really unique things going for it, and you know, I've gotten in the habit over the years of being involved in various projects at different levels to hope for the best, expect the worst, and more often than not, you know, you're like an actor going for an audition. It usually doesn't pan out. So
right.
I try not to get my hopes up, but after our time together, and we spent quite a few days working on a treatment for a pilot,
right.
I was totally taken aback by how much I liked the people that we worked with. What a remarkably terrific crew as far as their professional talents and what nice people we were thrown in with.
Yeah, I agree, Peter. Absolutely.
Why?
Very, very good. And Karen was present at that.
Yeah.
Well,
yeah, I'm not involved in the project, but I did get to go and meet the people, and I was kind of, I got to see some of it and take pictures of the filming, and it was really fun. Had a great
time. Yeah. Yeah, and again, we wish we could be a little more specific, but consider us men of mystery at the moment, and need to say, as it develops, if it does come to fruition, hopefully you'll all know about it because you'll be watching it regularly. And if for one reason or another it doesn't, then we can, of course, talk about it in detail anyway.
we'll certainly be talking about it on this show.
Yeah.
Anyway, but when we have more that we can share,
we will.
We'll get you guys back on and we'll talk about it.
Absolutely.
There, people are asking for sordid details on
that. Already, yeah, wow.
You want the sordid stuff?
We got sorted.
Oh, yeah.
Sorted or sorted. Oh, well.
Well, we spent a week and plus with Stanton Friedman, so what do you expect?
Yeah, that
which was great
got into.
Fun. I first met Stan, I think the late 70s, when I was doing one of the first shows that I did, and it was for Canadian television. And, you know, I was quite in awe. This is, of course, one of the deans of ufology, one of the true pioneers of this entire area of study. And some years later, I think 87 or so, we were thrown together again on another show. And I was rather frustrated because I had some months before met the late departed Philip Klass, who now lives with the aliens in the skies and knows that UFOs are real. And he had asked me a number of questions, and I thought, well, he seems sincere, and I obviously impacted on him with my talk. I'll be the one to turn him around. Well,
are you serious? You actually thought that?
Oh, yeah. Well, I was quite naive, and
everybody starts out with hope.
Yeah, and the upshot of it was, some months later, he wrote me that he had done a treatment for his then newest book, which I do not have in my library, called UFOs: A Dangerous Game.
Game, yeah.
Yeah, and one of his focuses, of course, being UFO abductions, I think, was a treatment on my sister's abduction experience, which is how I got involved in this work, to put it mildly. And it was absolutely god-awful. And I decided I was going to write the letter of letters, you know, absolutely decimating him, and I wasn't even going to deem myself to lower myself to communicate with him again, and I intended and did send it to his attorney. Well, at the time, I was my regular job was as manager of a repertory theater in New York City, and I had mentioned this to one of my acting buddies, who is a Royal Shakespeare trained actor, and said, let me help you with the wording on the letter. And when that letter went out, it was absolutely beautiful, and shortly after, I got a response from his.
Why did you send it to his attorney? Were you going to?
Well, I thought I didn't even want to condescend to deal with him. I wanted this out of this book. He had sent me the galleys, and it hadn't gone to press yet. My intention was that it would not see the light of day. Well, I got a letter back from his attorney saying, "Wonderful letter. Your case was beautifully made. Too bad you didn't get it to us sooner, because the book is going into print now." Well, shortly after, I was doing a television show in Canada, and I was quite caught up in my own frustrations, sitting in the green room before we went on. And Stan, who was also a guest, came up to me and at some point said my name, and I looked up, and there he is standing in front of me looking concerned. And he said, "What's wrong?" You know, obviously something was wrong. And I related the account to him that I've just told you. And his expression slowly changed from this look of concern to a big smile. And I looked at him wondering what was going on, and he stuck out his hand and he said, "Put her there. You're nobody in this field until Phil's attacked you."
Yeah, right. that's
wonderful to be working with
boys.
Yeah.
A few years ago, I was in the Canadian National Archives, and I found a letter that no one had seen. It was by Philip Klass from 1979, in which it was a really nasty, defamatory letter he wrote about Stanton Friedman to Canadian authorities. And the thing was, Stanton had just moved from the United States to Canada at around that time.
Yeah, his wife is Canadian.
That's right. And so Klass wrote this letter to leading Canadian scientists who were involved in sort of passively collecting UFO reports. At that time, Canada, like if you were a Canadian citizen and you saw a UFO, you could actually report it to the Royal Canadian Mounted Police.
Yeah.
And they wouldn't do anything about it. But they would take your report and they would send it to this other office.
Yeah.
I think up maybe in Ottawa. I don't remember where they were, but they would take the report and basically shove it in a file cabinet.
Yeah.
So I spent a few days up in Ottawa going through a lot of these reports. They were fascinating, fascinating reports. But one thing I found was literally the last folder I looked through.
Yeah.
After 3 or 4 days in these archives was this letter. I almost didn't open it. I thought, I should get out of here. I should leave. It's time for me to go. Was this letter by Philip Klass to the scientists running this program about this awful American who was coming up to Canada named Stanton Friedman.
Oh, no.
And they needed to be careful about him because he was a charlatan and a showman who was almost certainly going to bring unwanted attention to them personally and accuse them of a cosmic Watergate conspiracy.
Oh, wonderful.
Which was absolutely, of course, the furthest thing from the truth. But so I found this letter, and I'm thinking, well, Stan must know about this. I mean, this has got to be out. But I had never heard of it. So I thought, well, just to be safe, I'll photocopy the letter. I'll put it in order to copy it. You
sure.
Can just copy it on the spot. And I saw Stan that weekend at the Toronto Exopolitic Conference in 05. That was the first conference in which Paul Hellyer came out, by the way.
Oh.
But anyway, so Stanton spoke there, I spoke there, Paul Hellyer spoke there, Stephen Bassett. But I said to Stan, hey, you know, I just came across this letter by Klass about you. And he had no idea. And I'll tell you right now, he was ticked. I mean, Klass was dead by this point, I think, or about. He was either dead or it was
getting there.
Just about there, yeah. I think Klass had died. But Stan was abs. He had not known. He was really mad. But it was a nasty, nasty note by Klass. And the whole purpose of it, as I read this letter, was very clear to me. He didn't even care if it never got back to Stanton. What he wanted was to intimidate these Canadian scientists into staying away from the UFO topic altogether.
It was a nasty.
And what they did, there was some correspondence by these scientists that I was able to read in response to Klass's letter, and they were quaking in their boots. I'm not kidding you.
No.
They were afraid of being tainted with the whole UFO thing.
Oh.
And they were talking about finding a way to drop this program altogether.
Oh.
This is the kind of thing that Philip Klass did.
The power of intimidation, of
right.
level of debunking. He really had it down to a science, and there was something, you know, he could be extremely charming and often used it as a tool. But there was something very mean-spirited about him. And
he knew how to bully people who were of a weak constitution.
Yeah.
He really did. He knew how to intimidate, and a lot of times that's all it takes for a UFO witness, or particularly, not just an ordinary witness, I don't think he cared about them so much, but rather people in academia and science. I think Klass's number one goal throughout his career, frankly, was to throw enough cold water on this so that respectable people would stay away from the UFO topic, and he was very good at it. It's obvious that anyone who's read UFO cases and has some sophistication would know that Klass's arguments were just utter nonsense, and many of the times, most of the time, let's say.
But he studied with the dean of the School of Debunking. He was the accolade of Donald Menzel.
But his job wasn't so much to debunk inactuality.
No.
It was to intimidate the mainstream power structure from wanting to touch this topic. And of course, as we know, those of us who are talking on the show here, class was the number one authority that academicians would typically turn to.
Oh yeah, it's quoted.
When they wanted to you know, say that UFO, there was nothing to UFOs, they would go to aviation writer Philip Klass over at the Committee on Scientific Investigation for Claims of the Paranormal, and he was incredibly successful.
Yep.
At what he did.
And it's the mantle that he literally inherited from Menzel, who pioneered the science of UFO debunking and.
Yeah.
When really, if you could not attack the credibility of a case, in many cases you can't, then you attack the character of the witnesses. He was
exactly
a really low player, and I remember my sister once referring to him as Philip Klass, the man who has none.
Yeah.
Indeed. There really hasn't been an adequate replacement to Klass, if you really think about it.
No.
Michael Shermer,
other people
for a while. You know, it was up there. Now you got Bill Nye, who's utterly insignificant and incapable.
I can't visualize him without his silly body.
I remember watching that guy on PBS, Bill Nye the Science Guy. And
right.
I used to think he was cool.
Yep, sure.
He was so much fun.
The mantle of
the kid,
chief of debunkers.
TV.
Well, he's trying. I mean, you know, he's gotten an in with the Larry King show, so he's on there quite a bit. But it's very obvious that he's out of his depth. But he's trying to do the things that Klass was actually very good at doing, and that's to engage in. It's like a bowler. It's like when you roll the bowling ball down the alley, and you know it's not going to be a strike. So you try to use body English to get that ball in there to make the strike. And this is what these people do. When their argument's that bad, but then they gesticulate and they do all of these other irrelevancies
absolutely
to try to distract you and make you think that they've actually got an argument. And that's
no attention to them behind the curtain.
Right.
Yeah.
But Nye has a long way to go.
I think so, and we'll be keeping on his case as he tries to get there.
Yeah. Yes.
I wanted to, speaking from the ridiculous to the, if possible, even more ridiculous, just a few weeks ago, December 26th, Boxing Day, was one of those days where something happened in the goofball area of UFO studies that I'm just as happy that passed without most media picking up on it, which is something that was generated by the Canadian-based UFO cult, the Raelians, who I'm sure you're familiar with.
It's a
cult that called, the Raelians. Rael, R-A-I-E-L or something.
Rael, yeah. Whatever.
Yeah, he is actually a man named Claude Boreal. Claude is a French-Canadian journalist, as I recall, who...
Wasn't he a race car driver?
Maybe that as well. But he allegedly had a contactee experience and became, for me, a variation on the Billy Meier theme. And in his case, though, built a true UFO organization with uniforms and every bell and whistle possible. The only thing I was impressed by was his main recruiting tool has been for many years very attractive blonde women.
That's what I'm saying.
For most guys.
This is the thing I noticed about the Raelians. They got the best looking cult going.
I think so. And
join a cult.
They also their original emblem was one of the most shocking symbols I have ever seen in the world of symbology, and of course this was passed on to Rael by the Raelians themselves, and the alien aspect just has to do with the pronunciation, it's not a pun or anything. It was originally a swastika inside of a Star of David. Now if that isn't the most loaded symbol in the world, I don't know what planet these aliens came from.
Oh, my heavens.
But somewhere in the intervening years, either they came back and revised their message, or the Raelian designers modified it so that It's a much more ambiguous symbol now within the star.
The actual the Nazi swastika piece.
Yeah.
There's the more ancient, you know. There's a more ancient swastika. Which
I'll show you the version of the book when I know the reversed one. No.
Yeah.
I'll show you the edition of the book when you come here.
Well,
anyway, the reason I give these goofballs any airtime at all is because last December 26th, the Raelians declared International Orgasm Day. Which, I'm concerned, you know, it's...
You're concerned?
Yeah, I'm all for orgasms, but when you mix it with ufology, it does tend to bring the guffaws, winks, and nods.
Well, you got that.
So, anyway, I didn't want to let that important date in ufology pass without acknowledging it.
What was the date?
I believe it was Boxing Day.
December?
It was the day after Christmas, yeah.
So the day after Christmas is... National Orgasm Day?
Well, I think it's international or interstellar or something. I was lucky enough only to hear one news report of it.
I'm trying to remember. Did we catch it?
But I remember it well because the 26th was my mom's birthday, and you just might want to mark it on your calendar for next year to celebrate in some appropriate
way. I'll keep that in mind.
It
is on my calendar, and I'll tell you, everybody in the message board is joining.
Oh, dear.
All right, I'm there.
Right, from the...
Hey, I just noticed something odd fact about the two of you gentlemen. You both, your mother's birthday is on the 26th.
Ooh.
That's
different
true.
Months.
That's true. My
but when you
May.
Mentioned that,
Peter. Okay.
December 26th, Peter?
My birthday is at 28.
Uh-oh. Whoa, man, I'm getting freaked.
No.
My birthday's on the 1st. That's crazy. Think about it.
I'm much too much thought right now.
It means something. I got to think now what it might mean, but it's got to mean something.
I'm sure it must.
Saying, we're number one. I'm number one.
Yes,
honey.
It's true.
Yes.
It really is.
28.
Okay. Of course, now we have to fight with our daughter over that because she's on the 1st as well.
Oh.
Yeah, we do lock horns a lot.
Well, she is the 1st.
Okay.
I acknowledge that right away.
Hey, can I take a moment to tell you guys that
yeah.
I am looking right now at my book. The book I'm writing.
Oh, yes, might that be the legendary UFOs and the National Security State, Volume 2?
Volume 2.
It is real.
Yeah.
I'm looking at
mythical manuscript.
I'm looking at the words.
That book that's going to be out this year for the last few years?
Oh, God, yes. Well,
exciting.
And now it's really going to happen in 2009.
Right in front of me here, the Linda Cortelli.
Speaking on behalf of the greater ufological community, we are delighted.
Belgian triangles. I'm looking at 1989 here. It's looking pretty good. By the way, Peter, I have to tell you. Now, we were just before we went on the air.
Yeah.
I was telling you I've had a pretty good UFO library for many years, but I came into a massive, an utterly massive library. I would have to say that my personal library has got to be one of the best around now because I inherited from an elderly gentleman who recently passed away this year, in his 90s.
Yeah.
His entire library of more than about 600 books.
Oh, my God, Rick.
Journals of, the MUFON journal, which he'd given me years before.
And I just want to mention to anybody who's listening, most of you have not seen our house. It already looked like we built it out of books.
Yeah.
Earlier. Now we've got boxes in the attic. We've got boxes in Rich's office. We've got boxes on the front porch. We have boxes in the living room.
The front porch we've got adapted.
It's some pretty amazing stuff.
May I say?
They're very well protected. The gentleman's name was Bill Sherwood, Sherwood, and a real, real gentleman in his 90s. He and I became very close in his last 10 years. So I have a complete collection of MUFON journals, a near complete collection of the IUR.
Oh, my gosh.
A very excellent collection of the Flying Saucer Review, FSR.
I'm guessing also one of the best collections around of, hardcovers from the 50s on.
Yes, actually a very good collection of those, indeed. Some signed copies of George Adamski's books, in fact.
Oh, my God.
A number of others. But what I wanted to tell you, complete UFO magazine, and then a lot of lesser-known journals. And this is what prompted this discussion. I have a complete collection of journals from the year 1981 to 1985 of something called the SBI Report.
I thought you were going to say that. Isn't that interesting?
And this is a, I'm picking one off the shelf right here. This is co-published by you, Peter.
Well,
along with,
I was
this is Pete Mazzola,
the art director of the SBI.
Peter Mazzola is a friend of mine. I know Pete. You were, and Antonio Huneas, I see, was the overseas coordinator.
Right.
And you, Peter, were the art director of this publication.
I was.
And this is a neat, it's a really good quality magazine. Now, did it go for the 4 years that I have, or were there more than that?
I think there was a bit more than that. This deserves a little digression, because Pete Mazzola was not only one of the great unsung heroes among most people in ufology.
Well, yes, he's still around.
No. He passed away, actually, in June
of
1987.
Else. I'm thinking of somebody else. I'm very
yeah.
sorry.
He,
so, okay, go on.
Actually, was a bigger-than-life character who was one of my three main mentors as I came up through the ranks. He was... If you would have met him, you thought he was a character out of an old Kojak episode. Pete was a tough, no-nonsense, Italian-American, Brooklyn Roman Catholic, New York City police detective, and Vietnam veteran, who happened to be a crack UFO investigator, and who, after the dissolution of Project Blue Book, began to put together in his mind the fact that once he was a cop, if a regular person had a UFO sighting, they could no longer call the Air Force, which probably did the same things that the Royal Canadian Mounted Police did, put it in a filing cabinet, etc.
Mm-hmm.
But he created what amounted to, and the SBI was, that Scientific Bureau of Investigation, a national police officers' lobby of activists, UFO students, investigators. He helped to train police all over the United States in proper investigation techniques. And
yeah.
when I was working with them, they had hundreds of police officers from all over the country. And Pete had a 24-hour hotline in his home on Staten Island. And he would get calls day and night from cops all over the country who were getting reports, often in smaller towns, especially in cities, from people they knew well, grew up with, trusted, and respected. And I joined them at a point where the organization was making a huge dent. The first edition of Left at Eastgate, my book on the Rendlesham Forest incident that I wrote with Larry Warren, is co-dedicated to Pete, who died about a week before Larry Warren and I actually met and got together and started to work on this at, of all places, the 40th anniversary of Roswell Conference that MUFON held in 1987 at American University in Washington.
Oh.
Yeah.
May I ask, how is it that Pete died, Bobby?
A lot of people feel it was foul play, and a year or so ago I gave...
What was the actual official...
Well, what happened was, Pete, in the course of his 20-odd years in the New York City Police Department, had been shot, stabbed, beat up, suffered all kinds of injuries, and in his early 40s took early retirement, much to the delight of his wife and kids,
right.
to devote himself full-time to UFO study, lecture, and building this organization. And my feeling was, had he lived, he might well be sitting on another organization of the likes of MUFON right now. No joke.
What was the actual cause of his death?
Well, what happened was, and Antonio also was quite close to him, the first talk that he had been invited to give following his retirement from the NYPD, I don't remember where it was. I think it was in the Midwest. He flew to the airport and was picked up by his sponsor there. And they were driving to the motel where he would be staying that night. And this is where I think any sane mind can deduce that this was not foul play. In a totally freak accident, they were riding on the inside lane on a divided highway, and a car on the other side of the highway blew a tire. hit a stanchion post and went flying over to the other lane of incoming traffic. And they did it was a head-on collision. He went through the windshield, broke just about every bone in his body. That didn't kill him. It was more than a year into recovery, and he was recovering, that the doctors realized that there were neurological problems and something was wrong that they could not account for, and only that far into his recovery did they do an MRI and discover what was at that point an inoperable brain tumor. And he passed away in June of 87. I spoke to him a few days before then, and
that's very sad.
He was the greatest guy, a total character. And I should also mention...
I'm looking at his picture right here.
Oh, he was a tough customer and funny and a storyteller, too.
M-A-Z-Z-O-L-A.
Oh, okay.
Yeah, but and I'm glad that, you know, you brought this up, because many of our listeners here have never heard of him or the SBI. They're hardly even a footnote in American ufology, and they should be a great deal more than that.
Well, you know, the SBI, what I've discovered is that in the 1980s, it was really right before the Internet took off. Okay, I mean, the first bulletin board service ever that was for something other than computer programming geeks started in 1986. And guess what? It was UFO-oriented. A lot of people don't realize how the UFO field was indeed a pioneer in the Internet.
Along with porn.
Well, even before porn, frankly,
hey.
The reason is that in 1986, computers didn't have the kind of graphic capabilities that they would have in the
sure.
after that. So in 1986, what the Internet was, there
porn.
Was no web. It was all bulletin boards. If there was anything, it was just a bulletin board. That was the heart and soul of what was in the Internet. And in January of 86, a gentleman named James Spicer started the first bulletin
right.
board service that was not for geeks.
Yeah.
Well, it's for UFO geeks, but a different kind of geeks.
It was, too.
Met Jim years
ago. It was not a computer programming one, and it was all for UFO stuff, paranormal, but primarily UFO. So what I'm saying is that changed everything, and within a few years, that so deeply affected the UFO field. But before that, if you were a person who wanted to get some word out on this topic, what were your options? You know, there was the MUFON Journal, which had a distribution of less than 2,000. You could try to get an article in there. There were a couple of other journals, or you could start your own. You know, you'd have to go through the process of distribution and all of the hassles. It was never easy, but there were a number of these smaller UFO publications that were around in the 1980s, and they had greater or lesser levels of success. SBI was one of them. So it was really one of the last pre-internet era UFO publications.
Well, I should add something I'm very proud of, which, to the best of my knowledge, the SBI report was the first UFO publication to reproduce exact copies of declassified UFO-related documents. And that's something I'm very proud of.
Yeah, there's actually a very high quality character of the contributors themselves. I mean, I'm seeing articles by...
It's true, and we had several conferences.
Dr. Willie Smith, Antonio Huneas, I'm sure you probably contributed to this. I haven't seen... I saw a picture of you in here, Peter.
Yes, and he even carried some of my artwork, as well as
right.
various pieces that I did. It also... the SBI sponsored the very first UFO conference I ever spoke at, which I think... Of course, I was about 7 years old at the time. I'm much younger than I look. Was in Albany in about 1981 or 82. And at that conference, I learned a very valuable lesson. It was attended very heavily by professionals and an awful lot of cops. And whatever the big Albany paper was, they had a reporter there, as you can imagine, on the Saturday. And he was directed to me as one of the speakers and asked my thoughts. And I said something to the effect of, I want you to look around you and take a look at these people. A very high percentage of professionals. We have doctors, attorneys, a very large percentage of serving police officers, academics. What I'm trying to say here is we're not just a bunch of nuts who wrap ourselves in aluminum foil to keep out the gamma rays. And he thanked me, and he smiled, and he walked away, and knowing, of course, the next day there would be, you know, on Section 2 of page 1 of Section 2, a treatment of the UFO conference in Albany. I went through it immediately Sunday morning and found that sentence, which said, Peter Robbins, one of the speakers from New York, quote unquote, "We're not just a bunch of guys who wrap our bodies in aluminum foil to keep out the gamma rays," end quote, no further reference. What a lesson learned.
So anyway, I'm glad that I brought that up. I haven't plowed through. There's a few final projects that I have to get this book up and done, and SBI is one of them.
Let me just add, in closing on this chapter...
I've got a question from the message board that I will want to sneak in. Peter, go ahead.
Oh, yeah. That Pete Mazzola conducted regressive hypnotic sessions with myself and with my sister before I worked with Bud Hopkins, which I did for many, many, many years after that. And because he was a New York City police detective in a respected position... He regularly used the John Jay Police Academy voice stress analysis unit to run through audio tapes of UFO witnesses, abductees, etc., under hypnosis. And I still have all those printouts of how credible my sister's account was and my memory of writing together as well. He was a remarkable hypnotist, and at another time, I'll tell you some stories about that. But he was a great guy, and I should also add in closing that the Sherwoods, Bill and Rhoda,
yes,
who really were the loveliest people, I met them more than 25 years ago, and we had a number of talks, and I guess my last thought here is, just to go on the record with how bloody jealous I am of you and your new library.
Well, Bill was a friend of George Adamski, and he was a real contactee-oriented kind of person. Kodak, Eastman Kodak engineer, a man who taught himself Japanese and Portuguese at the age of 70. I mean, an incredibly erudite man and a gentle soul and extremely intellectual, penetrating, curious man, right up about the end. We hit it off for his last 10 years, and actually we became fairly close.
You're fortunate to have had him as a friend. That's great, Rich.
A very great man. Yes, Karen, you got a question.
Well,
yeah.
A couple of things, actually. I just wanted to mention to Peter that just last night we got to watch the TV movie treatment of Intruders.
Yes.
I've been wanting to see forever, but I couldn't track one down. But Bill Sherwood had it on VHS.
We just saw it.
It's on VHS, but I taped it off of CBS, as I recall. It's quite good.
Yeah, it was very good.
It was basically the main character. I was expecting it to be straight up from Bud Hopkins' book, but in fact the character is really a combination of Bud and John Mack, I would say. Right?
Indeed, yeah. And what had happened there was CBS had originally approached Bud about optioning Intruders, but the option was already out, and so CBS optioned Missing Time. Some months later, whoever held that option decided not to film it. The option returned to Bud, so CBS then optioned Intruders as well, and then their screenwriters grafted this play together. And this was about the time, of course, that John Mack was coming into play.
That's right, yeah.
Richard Crenna, the wonderful
He did a fabulous job.
Oh, he was fantastic.
He was terrific.
He looked like Bud Hopkins many times.
Well,
he had Bud's mannerisms, his expressions.
You're going to love this. You know, they felt they couldn't make him a painter because it just didn't have enough credibility, but they couldn't make him a psychiatrist because it was just pushing it too close to John. So Crenna was a psychologist, and being a good method actor with time to spare to prepare his character, he spent time in Boston with John and in New York with Bud and incorporated aspects of both their behavior.
It was evident.
Wow. Yeah.
I saw John Mack, and I saw Bud Hopkins, and I looked at Richard Crenna. I was very impressive. Karen and I were both very impressed.
It was very moving, and you know, Ben Vereen should have gotten an Emmy Award for his performance. Bud was very adamant that, of course, bringing Roswell in and an MP that had a nervous breakdown, you know, at the site,
like
was
that.
Institutionalized,
yeah.
was
yeah.
so far afield, but his performance was brilliant.
You
and
know what, though? I thought even the Roswell part worked.
Yeah! And Mayor Winningham, who we haven't seen in any films recently, she was superb in the Kathy Davis role. And, in fact, a number of the actors came to New York, and I met one or two of them, who were spending time with Bud at his studio to get a better sense of who their characters really were. So, yes, bravo to CBS on that, and to a gentleman named Jeff Sagansky, who was at
yes.
the creative president of CBS and shepherded that project, too, and still has a hand in the field, although is not as involved as he used to be. But it was first-class television, as far as I'm concerned. I'm delighted you finally had a chance to see it. I hope some of our listeners will seek it out. It is kind of...
Highly recommend if you are interested in a good spending 3 hours of your life to get a good sense of the Bud Hopkins, John Mack abduction story. It's a television movie, I assume. That's really
It was a very good over two nights.
It's a very good introduction.
Yeah. Peter, I actually have a quick question here.
Sure.
In the message board, there was some talk about, you know, there are new people joining us tonight who haven't before. And
oh, good.
So there was a bit of explanation. Who is this Peter Robbins? So
yeah, who is he?
Talking about Left at Eastgate and all of this. There was one question about how many people actually were present during Larry Warren's sighting at Rendlesham?
No, Rich and I were back and forth about this some time back, and I went back into the original recordings I made with Larry, double-checking them against other interviews I had done. There were probably, the best number I can give you is 40, give or take, on location in Capel Green, that specific field, where the third night's most dramatic incident occurred, the one that did not include Colonel Halt or a number of the other witnesses that have come forward since Larry did originally. But, yeah, it wasn't a huge, huge number. But the account, as published in Left at Eastgate, I think 40-ish is the number that we give.
Wow.
Which is
and there's
funny.
There's another question here about a case in England that I'd like to direct to both of you. Someone mentioned a recently publicized case in which a UFO apparently hit a turbine. I'm trying to find the mention of it again because it was rather a while ago.
You know,
have either of you heard about this?
I literally saw a reference to it about a week ago, and it came in
this is not the Melvin Torres case that was recently publicized when the MOD released their files.
I think that's it.
Yeah, well, what had this took place in the 1950s, if this is the correct question, if this is the correct answer.
I thought it was something recent.
It sounds a little different.
The question is, what do you think about the UFO hitting the wind turbine in England?
Bad piloting, or I wish I knew enough to have an intelligent opinion about it.
I know some people say, you know, they can drive those things all the way here, but they can't seem to land them properly.
Yeah,
although,
no
well,
comment.
They do. There are lots of landings.
Who drive like that?
The problem that I have with questions like that, with statements like that, is that, you know, it assumes that. That we actually know that they're coming from some other place. I mean, we don't. There's a lot of things we don't know, and so what we have to do is, you know, you gather data and you create a theory based on the data. You don't throw out the data because it doesn't agree with your theory if the data looks good.
Frankly, over the years, I've developed a certain cautionary attitude around colleagues and people in the field who allege that they do know the answers. With all due respect, maybe they do, but Martians don't channel messages to me. I don't have special privy to highly classified materials. What I can do better than most people, and you too, Rich, and Karen as well, because of our training, our studies, the fact that we're immersed in this field, that we travel constantly
Okay.
More information. We can ask better informed questions and make perhaps more logical deductions than some folks. But I wouldn't presume to say I know the answers. And it's been a cause of some frustration over the years for my readers who, in some cases, have said, you know, you begin and end left at Eastgate as a legal brief, saying we are going to present this information to you and you will be the judge and jury on it. And at the end of the book, I'm very careful to say this is what we now know. This is what we can deduce. This is what we think may be the case. This is an educated guess. This is what I fear. But at no point beyond the very obvious can I state, I know this.
Mm-hmm.
Much of it is unknowable still.
Okay, I just looked up the news story online.
Good.
And apparently it happened on January 4th.
Whoa.
A 90-meter-tall wind generator was damaged with one of its 20-meter blades torn off.
That was the reference I saw, but I did not do it.
Well, there was a newspaper story that blamed an octopus-shaped UFO.
Hmm.
Residents said they had seen mysterious flashing orangey-yellow spheres the night before.
Karen, do you know, does it mention in that piece where in England this occurred?
Near Conisholm.
Do me a favor, and sometime during the week, email me the link, and let me get in touch with colleagues in England, and maybe next month we can come back with some more detail or information on this case for that particular listener and other listeners.
The newspaper says that someone came forward and said that she had arranged fireworks for her father's birthday celebration less than 2 miles away.
Okay.
Someone else writing in the newspaper said some of the pyrotechnics, quote, looked rather like octopus tentacles.
As they do.
I don't know. I mean,
not to say that those two things could not have been happening at the same time, but
mm-hmm.
no one has to take the other into consideration. But if something struck...
this was January 3rd, Karen, did you say?
It happened on the 4th. Well, it was discovered on the 4th, so it was the night of the 3rd.
I'm looking at files right now, and I'm looking at a Manchester case of January 3rd. Orange balls. Six bright orange balls traveling toward Manchester at 12:15 a.m. That's
same one,
a little
but
different.
Let's do some research and see if we can...
Sounds like a brand new case.
Next month.
The problem that I have is that, as Karen will attest, and Peter, you too, is that my head is right now in a place of about 20 years ago.
I'm
in 1990 and 91. and actually right now I'm going through some old UFO press clippings and things
very
like that, just doing some final touches.
I joke...
To stay current is kind of tough.
But
I'll catch up at some point soon, I hope.
I joke with you all the time, but we our colleagues, we are so excited about this book coming out. For some years now, I've always kept two copies of UFOs in the National Security State, one which I've loaned out repeatedly because a tiny handful of other books, among which would be Above Top Secret or Tim Good's Beyond Top Secret, it is one that I know I can hand out to intelligent, skeptical friends and acquaintances that will stop the silliness. And you've made a tremendous contribution to the field. You're about to make another one, and get started on the third one as soon as possible, if you would.
Oh, well, the good news is that the research for that third volume is, let's say, 95% done.
Holy moly.
I've already done it, because I originally was planning to do Not a history from 1973 to 91, but I was planning to do a history from 73 to the present. And
sure.
When I was researching it, I went right up into the 21st century, but I've decided I can't. So all of that research I've done for the 90s and for the 21st century, that's still here. I've got it all, and it's nicely organized, and it's ready to go. So when this book is done...
You're back to work.
Well, that's right, and I've got my game plan, and it won't be that long await as this book has been. This has been a very, very major undertaking, but what I've often, you know, have to remind people is that when I finished that first book of mine, and then the first edition was actually finished in mid-2000, and then I did a revision of that for 2002.
Right.
And so that's a long time ago, but the thing was, when I finished that book, I had done everything I could to get the history up to that point, and I didn't honestly know comfortably a lot of the recent history. I had to get up to speed really fast, and the difficulty was that once that first book came out, people were treating me as though I was an expert on everything. And I really had to work to get up to speed. Now
and
I
that's really a bad thing. It's really, really hard to live with him like that. I mean,
we also very view with the dynamic that the more you do, the more you find there is to do.
That's right. I mean, it's
on that note, I need to interrupt. I'm so sorry, gentlemen, but we need to go to break.
Sounds good.
Yeah.
Break.
I'm sorry. I've been getting all these little hints and nudges, and it's not going to happen. No, we do need to take a break. This is Through the Keyhole on the Paranormal Radio Network on UPRN 105.3 FM in New Orleans and on online on PRN.org. I'm talking tonight with Rich Dolan and Peter Robbins, both ufology researchers and authors. We are having a blast. Don't go too far. We'll be back in a few minutes for the second hour of Through the Keyhole. Hi. Oh, we're about to start again. Hi, everyone. We're back. You're listening to Through the Keyhole on the Paranormal Radio Network and on UPRN 105.3 FM in New Orleans. I'm your host, Karen Dolan, and my guests this evening are Peter Robbins and Richard Dolan. These are two UFO researchers and authors, and we're doing our once every month or so get-together for a chat between friends on current events, what projects we've got going on, what's coming up in the news. We had a really terrific time the first hour, and welcome to the second hour. We talked about a couple of things that I don't know if we still want to talk about the wind turbine case we were looking into. Somebody brought up in the first hour.
We were ourselves making a few jokes about, you know, quite to be blunt, you know, flying saucers hitting a windmill. But it's not a joking manner, and this is a classic example of the kind of thing that the media loves to seize on and poke fun at.
The British media, I'm looking at the tabloids on this, they have such a long history of doing this.
They're the best.
Impossible for them to take this topic seriously. And so they've got a picture of Mary Poppins up in the sky there and a fly. The wind turbine is totally messed up.
I did see one story where they give a possible explanation of it as maybe it was ice thrown from a neighboring turbine that struck it.
Mm-hmm. May well be.
I don't think they're going that fast. I mean, ice to hit metal.
I'm looking at
and
these
do
turbines
sort of damage
and the distance.
With it.
No,
that's a lot of ice moving at a very high rate of speed.
A lot of ice, and it would have to hit pretty darn hard. That doesn't sound like a plausible explanation to
doesn't
me at
really.
All.
Well, any of us probably need to really read up on the case. Were the turbines in motion? I assume they were. So if you have ice buildup, it seems very implausible to me.
I think I'd have to agree with you, and I think it's incumbent on all three of us to do some homework between now and when we get together next month on the air to see if we can present a more serious picture of what we feel happened.
There's a statement by Nick Pope about it. He called it potentially one of the most significant UFO cases in years.
Oh, very good. If Nick said it, worth taking seriously.
Yeah. There's a gentleman here from the University of Nottingham who is an expert in the design and manufacture of these turbine blades who says if the turbine blade was still, it would take the equivalent of a 10-ton load to do that kind of damage.
That's not
ice. If it was rotating or hit by a moving object, he said the force could be a lot less. He said it could be ice thrown from a neighboring turbine that struck it. Now, you know, to me, I look at that and I'm thinking, how could a piece of ice, unless it was thrown at nearly supersonic speed, do that kind of damage? And you have to go online and look at the pictures.
Well, it's a piece of ice that would not only shear off one of the three blades, but it would also ruin a second of the blades.
Yeah.
Interesting.
The fact that
an official explanation is put out that sounds, on the face of it, maybe I'm completely wrong and maybe this really is what happened, but it sure sounds implausible.
Yeah.
Well, it sounds like he was just tossing it out there. I don't get the idea that he's trying to say that that's what happened.
I don't know. I think he says it's definitely not a bird. It could be ice thrown from a neighboring turbine. It sounds to me like he's putting it forth as a possible explanation.
And I'm no engineer, but to get that amount of ice moving that fast so that the impact, would register as though it were a 10-ton object colliding with this stationary tower.
The other thing is, were there witnesses who said, they saw things? I haven't even gotten that far.
There were several witnesses, not in the story that I've got pulled up at the moment, but in others that I've looked at. There were several witnesses who claimed to have seen various lights the night before. And then they get up the next morning, and here's this one windmill has two turbine blades broken.
Here's one guy who said it looked like a giant explosion in the air.
Yeah.
I saw one who said he saw a large white light that seemed to be hovering.
Okay. So basically, a strange phenomenon, and then you got this bizarre, unexplained result.
Mm-hmm.
Fascinating.
So it is interesting.
The point that I wanted to make just about tossing out this ice explanation is when an official channel puts out an explanation that really sounds so implausible, it honestly just makes everyone in the public say, what are they really trying to hide? I mean, that's got to be a cover story.
He could just be scratching his head because, I mean, really think about it. Mm-hmm. Pretend you don't believe in UFOs. So just rule that out. So then, what could it be if you're really trying to reach for an explanation?
Exactly, and maybe it was ice. I don't know. All I'm saying is the effect of that is to make people like us say, oh, there's got to be something other. There must be something they're hiding. That can't possibly be it.
One of my guiding principles in research for many years now, I learned when I was about 12 years old and quite fell in love with the work of Arthur Conan Doyle and his legendary detective Sherlock Holmes. And in Holmes' methodology, deductive reasoning is a mainstay in all of the cases that he and Dr. Watson investigate. And its basic precepts are that you begin to investigate a mystery or a crime with the most mundane, passé, everyday explanations. If they do not hold up, you move on one notch to the one that seems more phenomenal. And if when you are done, what you are left with is only the most phenomenal explanations, it may well be just that.
Right.
Yep. And in that spirit, I want to bring to your attention and to our audience's attention a book that I'm just finishing up right now that I'm very impressed by and dovetails so solidly into your work, Rich, that we can only keep up with so much in the publishing world, but it covers quite a bit of the territory that you've covered, but in a very specialty focus. The book is called Strange Company, Military Encounters with UFOs in World War II. The author is a gentleman named Keith Chester, and it's published by Anomalous Books. Keith is an artist and filmmaker, and he lives in Maryland and witnessed a daylight UFO sighting in the 1960s, much like I did. And that was the course of his interest, and it is what it says it is. It is a fine piece of research, point by point by point, of UFO encounters in World War II. And it's just a terrific book, and I've been back and forth with him by email now.
Now, does it appear include European and Pacific theaters of war?
Exactly.
It does.
Yes. He really has honed in, and like so many of us that are self-trained in investigation, he has given us a wonderful new aspect. Again, you'll be familiar with many of the cases that he has honed in on here, but I would say to you guys, this is one definitely to add to your library. And
may I ask you, Peter?
Yeah.
You know, regarding, because when you talk about World War II UFO sightings, you're talking about what we'll call Foo Fighters.
Yes.
And, of course, there's a very widespread theory, not without merit, with a lot of merit, that tries to do some connecting of the Foo Fighter mystery to that of German technology.
Absolutely, and some of it may well be accounted for in that sense. Like
now,
a good investigative writer, he does not end by telling us exactly what it is because he doesn't know. He just presents very well-drawn and written treatments and keeps the story moving from theater to theater through all of the accounts that are on the official record that we have.
Well, the thing is, and I mean, do you get a sense when you read these accounts? The problem that I've always had with using German technology as the sole explanation.
Oh, yeah.
Is the prevalence of sightings in the Pacific Theater.
Yep.
In particular, I have a hard time imagining how you've got the Germans, who, especially after 1943, were on the defensive the whole.
Oh, yeah.
They're going to be sending all of their these flying saucers out to help Japan.
It wouldn't have happened.
You know, in getting them to Japan, it was no small matter.
So no.
You got to go through the Soviet Union and the Middle East. So it wasn't impossible. You could do it, but not easy.
Cannot account for all of the very very distinguished and respectable individuals. There's no way. There's no way. The mystery remains, but it's a new look at it, and
I'd like to
was recently a guest on Coast to Coast, and I'm guessing we'll be hearing more about him and hopefully hearing him on the lecture circuit at some time in the not-too-distant future.
Germans were working on things that, when I was doing my research a decade ago, I have to admit, if there's one real regret I have for my book, it's that I didn't dig into the German connection enough. Of course, there wasn't as much even then available as there is now. Nick Cook's excellent book.
I was going to say, throw points.
But the Germans were working on disc-shaped airframes. They were.
Oh, yeah.
They had varying degrees of success. So, you know, now the question is, did they create the flying saucer design, or, as some have argued, did they in turn get that from their own UFO sightings?
Well, exactly, and the answers to those questions are not available to us. It takes me back to
they're not. They're
fine
not.
Book.
Peter, I have a comment in the message board. A D in the chat room wants to thank you for bringing up that book.
Oh, yes, that has got to be Dee Andrew, who is a good friend,
mm-hmm.
and who, along with her husband David, produce a terrific radio show out of Arizona, Eye to the Sky. Hiya, Dee, and hiya, David. And they were the ones that brought Keith's book to my attention.
There's just so much really terrific stuff out there. We were talking about how many books we have now, because Rich just inherited quite a few, but it's just amazing me how many really excellent books there are on UFOs and related topics.
And from that period of time that I'm imagining is well represented in your new collection, there are some goofy, goofy books as well.
And UFOs? Goofy?
The 1950s was replete with many of them, and I think one of my, I've got so many favorites, but Howard Menger's From Outer Space to You is one of the best, really. I use the word goofy with great respect in terms of the contactee movement. There's certainly something to it, but there was some loopy stuff going on and being
right here,
passed
here.
Off.
I have a hard cover. Let's see if I have a signed copy of it.
You rat.
Howard and Connie Menger.
They will.
No, but it is a hardbound first edition.
Damn you.
That's kind of, I haven't read this one, but there's some pretty wild-looking pictures.
And it's got one of the... does it have the dust jacket on it?
Yes, it does. Wild-looking.
Yeah, that is a painting that Howard Menger did. The female alien had a great resemblance to his wife, much as the legendary... Semyase.
You know, the thing about Howard Menger, I got to say this: the dude looked like a rock star.
Totally,
James Dean.
He's got that. Absolutely, he's got that great DA and sort of that rockabilly look.
He did. He had these cool sunglasses, good haircut. He was a good-looking guy. And Connie Menger in the '50s.
He was hot. Yeah.
They were the thing. They were the hot UFO couple of the '50s.
Well, for what it's worth, I have somewhere in my archives a 78, I think. Maybe it's a 33 1/3, but it is an actual recording of songs that were written and performed on the planet Venus. And I swear to you, it sounds very much. The instrument sounds a great deal like on Earth what we would call an accordion. I'm sure it's absolutely authentic recording, and maybe with any luck I'll be able to pull it out and
let me put a theory out to, you and to the listeners.
Okay.
Let's wonder now. Okay, the contactees of the 1950s, I mean, they were a fascinating cultural phenomenon.
The logical
people who talked about the Space Brothers. This is a phrase that they often used.
Yeah.
We're here concerned about our nuclear proliferation, and later it was environmental problems and so on. What if some of that was true?
Oh, yeah.
All right, so what if some of these individuals met beings who might have said were from Venus?
Mm-hmm.
All right, whether they were or weren't.
Has a very inhospitable atmosphere, but, oh, hey, I'm a human being. What do I know?
All right, so let's just say that they're not from Venus, or there's some other explanation.
Sure, dark side of the moon, perhaps.
I mean, you know, imagine if you or I, we were to go back to the medieval times, as we are right now, okay? So we're back 1,000 years ago, walking among the people, and you run into locals. First, you have to master their language. So you learn how to speak proto-French or proto-Italian or Latin or whatever. You figure that part out. Now you got to talk to these people if you want to, if you feel the need to. So how do you explain who you are to them? You can't exactly give them the whole download of everything that we are in 2009. I mean, that would kind of freak them out. So you've got to...
You'd probably be burned as a witch.
You have to go by bits and pieces. And I have sometimes wondered that that might have been happening with these contactees of the 50s, that there might be... In fact, I would suspect that there is a core of truth in what's going on there. Now, it's been overlaid with a lot of their own ideologies and ideas that they work into it. I mean, looking at this contactee library that I now have from my old friend Bill, you know, what you can see is that you've got very intelligent, thoughtful, hopeful people writing in this who see in these Space Brothers a chance to kind of redeem humanity. And so maybe this was a seed that might have been planted by some good beings. Let's say that there are some good beings out there. So I'm not willing, as I would have been 10 years ago, to dismiss it all as a lot of hokum. That doesn't mean that you can accept it. There's a middle ground here, I guess is what I'm saying.
Well, let me offer an alternate other theory. For many years, coming up through the ranks in UFO studies, like many of my colleagues, I tended to disdain the works of George Dembski categorically. I felt, at best, he was a well-meaning kind of kook, and at worst, a charlatan. I think somewhere along the line I may have given you the DVD set of UFO footage that some years ago I optioned from Mike Hesseman and his old UFO file.
I downloaded two of the three volumes.
Yeah.
So if you've got the third volume, I would love to have it, by the way.
No, the company I work for, they just did those first two. But among the 250 included in that two DVD set is some 8mm footage that George Adamski shot while visiting, I think, Marilyn Roediger in Maryland.
I've seen it.
In the 1950s, and I find this footage mesmerizing. Essentially, it is dusk. It looks like a field in rural Maryland. The quality of light is quite nice, and you're looking at a tree line in the background and a field, as I recall, in the foreground. But in the sky over the area is an anomalous flying thing. And it's moving around with the freedom of motion you'd associate with an insect. It's here and then it's there like a hummingbird. I'm sure I've watched it 100 times, and over those viewings, I've come to feel that if not earlier, and he may well have had an initial sighting or experience when he was younger, he definitely filmed a truly anomalous object. There's no question in my mind that whatever it is, it's undoctored footage. And so I began to think that Adamski and maybe a number of other people, maybe Billy Meier, maybe a number of other people whose claims are not fully substantiable to many of us, had an initial sighting or event in their life that absolutely transformed them, made them into something of an activist, a zealot, and that in their ethics, in their code of the way they move forward in life, they simply made a quiet agreement with themselves that
this is a very common thing.
Series of smaller, quote-unquote, white lies in the service of a great truth is acceptable. I've always taken the point of view that if you're caught fabricating, you're a liar, and in our field, it can only happen once, and you're cooked.
Okay, it's not that simple. You go back through this history of 19th century mediums. Karen knows this very well, the famous Fox sisters.
Some are real.
Upstate New York.
Come very close to where we are, actually.
Yeah. Actually, you too, Peter.
Yeah.
And, Karen, you probably know this far better than I do, but these appear to have been very possibly genuine mediums who, for a number of years, had their thing going where they heard rapping from spirits, mm-hmm. but then were, am I right, Karen, in thinking they were caught once or
they were
accused of fabricating?
They were, exactly, and they were probably proven, I believe, to have been faking on at least one occasion. And, you know, the question arises, these were teenage girls by the time they were caught. They had all this pressure on them.
Yeah.
I cannot believe that the spirits can be just called up and expected to perform every time, which is what people were expecting. They were traveling a long way to come see these girls. They were paying for a seance. They wanted phenomena. If they didn't get it, then they would go away and tell everyone these girls were fake. So if nothing's happening, if you know it's real but it's not happening right now, there has to be this incredible temptation to fake it, just so these people go away happy and they get off your back, because it's real.
Think about a guy like Adamski. I mean, just pretend that you were George Adamski. Let's pretend that in, I think it was 1952, you had that major experience where the ship comes down and you got some people with you. And by the way, I'm not aware of any of those individuals who ever refuted that. I know there were certain people who were absolutely loyal right through and past the end, long after Adamski died. So let's say, pretend that happened. And so now you become famous. You got a book out, and you become a guru, and someone that thousands and maybe millions of people invest their hopes in. So now you're far beyond the point of just this guy going out on his own, exploring and looking for truth. So now you've got some pressure. And it's not hard for me to see that in that kind of a situation, you might, in fact, engage in fictionalizing things in order to promote that true thing that you know did happen to you. And that's a human flaw, and it's unfortunate, but that's how a lot of people are. Most of us are probably like that. And so I'm not prepared to say that George Adamski was legitimate, by the way, but I will say this. We've mentioned our deceased friend Bill Sherwood.
Yeah.
And I must say I was deeply impressed by the caliber of Bill Sherwood's devotion to Adamski right up until the day he died. But it was an informed devotion. Bill Sherwood knew Adamski personally and knew as much about ufology as anybody.
Yep.
That was it. And he was a very scientific man. He was not pie in the sky type of guy person. So it's people like that would give me pause before I would simply dismiss out of hand any of these stories.
I think it's a fair point, Rich. Again, I think all the more reason that those of us that try to maintain a credible, respectable presence in this field need to be doubly on our own cases to not fall prey to, as you say, that very human failing. And, you know, again, well, I think that says it. I think that says it. The discipline that is involved is so important, and for somebody who really has a good reputation in the field to jeopardize it in such a manner is tragic. So, Yes, we have a number of mysteries relative to the entire contact team movement. What comes down to most of us is the sociological aspect of these kind of almost pre-hippies making, you know, their views known in the Eisenhower-McCarthy days, most of them not terribly articulate or even very well educated, and the bits and pieces of film footage of early conferences and contactees are overall laughable. But that is no reason to throw out the baby with the bathwater. So it is another ongoing, unresolved aspect of this whole extraordinarily serious area of study
right.
that we're immersed in.
Let me add one other thing, since some, you know, we're thinking about this. I find myself now in a position where I'm not 100% in the same place I was mentally a decade ago.
I guess.
And I find that there are readers and listeners, when I'll do an interview, they want me to be that person I was in 2000 when my first edition of my book came.
Sure.
And that's not possible. What I have to continue to work to do is to explore and learn in this field. And if that takes me places that some people don't want me to go, I find frequently I'll write or say things, and I will constantly get positive, but I get negative feedback from people over new positions that I end up taking, whether they're political, whether they're philosophical, whether they get into some of the more bizarre or esoteric things that I'm not supposed to do because I'm supposed to be a just-the-facts, nuts-and-bolts ufologist,
yep.
as
yep.
some people like to think.
Yeah, but then they blame it on me.
They do. Yeah, I blame it on you, Karen.
Blogs, people say, oh, Rich Dolan's
right,
spending
right.
too much time with his wife
or
these days.
Too new agey or you know, whatever.
I just want to say
I'm
right now, he is not in any way spending too much time with his wife. He is not spending nearly enough time with his wife. Let me just put that out there.
Oh, awkward moment, listeners.
I come to my own ideas, and I can honestly say any thought that I have is my own, and I've always been very fiercely independent in that way.
Well,
well that's the other thing I say about these blogs. You know, if anybody thinks that I or anyone else can change Rich's mind about anything, they got another thing coming.
Also, I mean, if anyone out there feels that you can immerse yourself in this work to the degree that we have for the years that we have and remain untouched and unchanged by it, or not have your attitudes, ideas, and preconceptions rattled to their core, think again.
Yeah. Yeah, very, very, very true. Mm. This is a field that just completely shatters your paradigm every so often. I've gone through probably a 10 or so new paradigms since I've done this, no kidding. And every time, you know, in the first few years, I would make some breakthrough, and I think, oh, now I'm really feeling like I understand how this world works. And that holds for maybe a few months or a year, and then there's you go deeper and deeper and deeper. And it's just, I'm at the point personally where I'm so far out there, I can't fly on an airplane and talk to people. Cringe. I avoid people.
Without them have their seats changed.
Well, inevitably, because I'm sitting next to some guy or some gal who's got an Excel spreadsheet, you know, on their laptop, and then they'll look over to me and they'll say, oh, so what do you do? And what do I say to such a person? How do you get into this by saying, yeah, well, actually, I'm in a place where I feel like you're living in the Matrix, pal, and you've actually got this false reality that you're living in.
It's where
black just dive into that. I say, oh, well, I do UFOs. Well, that's interesting.
And then,
but then, it, to
then
get
there
that,
are two ways that can be really bad. Either the person is completely not into it, and they think you're nuts, and now you're sitting next to this person.
Or they're so interested, there goes the rest of your flight. Tell me
that's
everything.
Happened, yes.
Yeah.
Yes.
You know, you
or
reminded
you get somebody
me.
Who is really
I go
interested.
Through a kind of reaction every once in a while, and it goes back to having met and become friends with Bud Hopkins the year after he became involved in UFO studies. In fact, I'm proud to say that Bud and I did our very first talks together on the same stage, stage of the School of Visual Arts where I was teaching painting at the time in 1977 or 78. So I knew Bud really before he began to look into what he's now internationally known for, the abduction phenomena research. And being at his side for so many of those years and having spent time with hundreds of individuals who allege, and I feel the great majority of whom that we work with were authentic in the experiences they describe, not to mention having a sister who also seems to have gone through it, that every once in a while, it can happen once or twice a year, once every 2 years, I literally go through a physiological reaction of freezing up and feeling a chill and going, my God, this is really happening. And I expect that will happen to me on and off for the rest of my life. It's not anything that you can ever fully get used to. It is happening. And a few years into it, I went into therapy. And part of the reason was I was finding myself walking down a street in midtown Manhattan and going into a kind of split-screen reaction where I saw myself on the street with all of these sleepwalking people who have no idea of how real this subject is and the implications of it, and inevitably I would feel like Kevin McCarthy at the end of the Invasion of the Body Snatchers, standing out on the highway screaming at passersby, they're here, you're next.
Yeah.
And then continue down the street.
The problem that even guys, folks like us have is, you know, we live with this topic and we live with this reality, but we also live in a world where this reality is not accepted in general.
Yep.
And so we have two minds. You know, we've got a mind that works and functions in the day-to-day practical world that we have to live in with friends and associates who don't really think about the things that we think about.
Indeed.
And so it's very easy, even I think for most of us, to go through our daily routine where this is not a reality. And we're not running into extraterrestrials or interdimensionals or whatever they are on a daily basis to our knowledge. And so it's not something that really is going to affect us on that basis. So it is easy, even now, for you or me or Karen or anyone else to have to stop and just say, wow, yes, this is real. This is real. And incorporating it into one's worldview.
I think
that's always the hard thing to do.
All
the
more
times, too, when that sneaks up on us, even people like us who do deal with this idea, we think about it pretty frequently. We look at evidence. And we think we've accepted this, and we've internalized it. And then we come across one more piece of evidence, and we feel like, I know what's happened to me. Suddenly I feel like I just got punched in the stomach. Like, oh, my God, this is real.
Yeah.
And I'm thinking, wait a minute. I felt like it's been real for the past couple of years. Well, apparently I just hit a new level of proof.
Yeah. I think also if, unlike me, you are parents, there has to be an entirely separate and equally imposing dimension because you are bringing your children up in a world where this is going on. And
that's right. We're continually making new decisions. Last night, Elaine, our 10-year-old daughter, watched.
I thought she was 30.
A portion of Intruders with us.
Oh, whoa!
I'm sorry. You thought she was what, Peter?
30.
Yeah.
Well, you've spoken with her.
It's happened. People have thought that. And, in fact, Karen and I really didn't want Elaine to see it because it's some very disturbing themes in there. But it turns out Elaine caught, about a half hour's worth of it, and I think she appreciated it. Wasn't as freaked as we
I thought she would be. I had put off watching it for a few days until she was busy doing something else because I didn't want to be watching it while she was there.
No, but in fact, I think we were monitoring her during
it. Yeah, we were
as well.
There. I was ready to turn it off.
But I think she handled it actually very well.
Mm-hmm.
If among the many, many treatments of the subject that have made their way to film or television, the acting is of such a quality, and the story is so well told in a generally unhysterical manner. If I had an intelligent, preteen that really wanted to get a little bit of viewing time on the subject, I would consider sitting and watching some of that with them, although not the part where Mayor Winningham looks down into the frying pan and sees the two eggs staring up at her.
No, actually,
out.
That was early on, and Elaine didn't see that part.
Good.
So.
Me off fried eggs for a while.
Yeah.
I missed that part, actually.
It was way at the beginning, yeah. She looked down, she saw two eggs frying in the pan, and it triggered a memory of the eyes, the alien's eyes.
Oh, wow.
Looking
at
her.
Wow.
And it was amazingly well filmed.
It surely was, and again, Mare Winningham is a consummate actress, and she met and spent time with Kathy Davis in Indiana in doing her work to develop that character. Yeah, no question about it.
Well, we are actually nearing the end of the show here. We've got about 15 minutes.
That's impossible. We've had a missing experience then. I want to bring up some
fun.
Didn't get
well,
to
I know there were a couple of other things that we all wanted.
You might have some message board things, too, of folks that have something that they'd like to ask of us.
Well, I know that I wanted to talk about some of the new conference information that we have coming up.
You should
do
that.
All have some. And there are a couple things that I want to ask you about, Peter.
Yeah.
And I wanted to mention, too, I'm really excited. I have news. I'm going to be working at the International UFO Congress this year.
Oh, wonderful.
From 22nd to 28th. I'm actually their new media relations person.
Are you? That's wonderful.
I am so excited. Thank you.
That's so ironic. I was just emailing Nicole Brown Irving today, about some related stuff. But congratulations. What a great job.
I am just having a blast with it. I have no idea what I'm doing, but Nicole is so great to work with,
yep.
And we're having a blast. We're figuring this out as we go along.
Well, when we see each other next weekend,
enrollments are up.
With you on that, because that's one of the jobs that I have for the city of Roswell.
Great. I am so excited you're going to be doing that again this year.
Yeah, the city of Roswell, New Mexico, has rehired me to act as their media liaison, conference coordinator, advisor on building tourism. One of the most exciting aspects is that I'm the person once again charged as a liaison between the city government and the festival committee and Governor Richardson's office, which was a very challenging and rather delicate part of the job last year, and he is remaining governor of New Mexico, of course, and it has to be approached in a very tactful manner, so I'm very glad to have the challenge again, and at the end of this month we'll begin meeting with the folks in Roswell regularly in the phone conferences that we have leading up to the conference the first week of July. And for your three listeners out there who do not know much about the International UFO Congress, of which you are now an employee, this is the premier UFO-related event in America every year. It is a week long. It takes place in Laughlin, Nevada, the last week of February and often into early March. They bring in anywhere from 25 to 40 speakers from up 20 countries. There's a film festival, various seminars. It's a huge event that can draw upwards of 1,000 people from all over the world. So
the price, Karen. It's actually very low.
Yeah, I wanted to mention that we've got 30 speakers this year.
Great.
And I do have a little bit more news on that in a moment. The early registration deadline is coming up. It's January 19th. And if you register on the 19th or before that, you can get the entire conference, the entire week long, all the presentations, the speaker party on Wednesday night, the banquet on Saturday night, the film festival, everything, including a room at the Aquarius Hotel and Resort. And it's all for $499.
Oh my gosh.
For the entire week. I'm thinking there isn't any place else where you can get a hotel room for a week for that amount of money.
That is extraordinary, and this is not Las Vegas. This is a really interesting remote corner of Nevada, right on the Arizona border. Plus, for what it's worth, as one aspect of this amazing series of events and lectures, we're very familiar, those of us that work these things, with the banquets, and they're all well-meaning, they're enjoyable, but often, or at least sometimes, to be kind, the food is not great. You're not there for a gourmet meal. You're there for the ambiance and the excitement and the people. I don't know how they do it, but the banquets that they have at the Congress are sensational. And you guys remember last year, that meal that they served for over 600 of us was terrific from start to finish.
Yeah,
that's not why you're going there, folks, but Rich and Karen and I all had the honor of being there last.
Well, the neat thing about these conferences is that there are just so many fascinating people to meet.
Oh, yeah, and often
the speakers are really cool usually, but the attendees are just as interesting.
Yes, often more
people. It's, that's right. So it's always, the thing about a conference is you get to meet people, you develop friendships, and it's a worthwhile experience.
Yeah, I've been telling people, what I found was the most fascinating about the whole thing was you get to spend several days with people who don't think you're crazy when you want to talk about UFOs.
I know,
and
you forge wonderful friendships as well.
Yeah, and then you can be having lunch in the hotel restaurant, and you look up and there's, you know, somebody like Jim Mars at the next table.
Yeah.
And you can just go over and say, hey, I really enjoyed your talk. And he's like, yeah, great, join me, you know, half the time.
No, you're all in it together, and
right.
Is one of the most enjoyable aspects of the work that we do, because so much of it is extremely solitary. That is the nature of research.
Right.
But the good, well, the upside of it, not that I don't enjoy research, but I really love people, and it is so much fun and so gratifying to spend time with people, not just who are interested in the subject, but in some cases who have actually read things that you've written and have interesting observations or comments about same. It's very satisfying and, again, an awful lot of fun. I can't encourage any of our listeners strongly enough to make that your vacation week, and especially for that kind of price.
This is the first also for one famous person.
Yeah, Stan Friedman is going to be speaking there this year.
Oh, for goodness sakes, he's
never done.
He's never, ever spoken in Laughlin before. But
that's got to be the only conference on the planet, and a few on other planets.
Yeah, I know.
Well, the Crash Retrieval Conference.
Amazing.
That's huge. And they're doing several new things this year. They've also got Ed Grimsley coming. He's bringing his night vision goggles and equipment, and they're going to actually take people out in a bus away from the lights of the hotel, and we're going to do some sky watching with the night vision goggles.
Wonderful.
And they've invited a psychic for the first time ever. They have never had a psychic come before, but we've got Marissa Ryan coming this year.
And I think Stan's going to do a psychic reading with her, isn't he?
I don't know.
Right.
We could ask him.
I kid because I love.
Stan, if you're listening.
And I'm hoping to have some of the conference speakers on Through the Keyhole in the upcoming weeks as well, so we'll be able to talk a bit about their work, what they've done in the past, and what they're going to be talking about at the conference.
That's very smart. I would advise all of your listeners to keep listening, because if you're not already convinced, if you have some budgetary leeway to go to this wonderful event, some of those interviews will definitely set you in that direction.
I need to mention, too, we've talked about taking a week away to do this, and this is a week-long conference. However, you don't have to go for the entire week. You can choose one day. You could come for one presentation if that's what you want to do.
Mm.
It's possible to, you know, choose one day, 2 days, whatever. They have a complete a la carte registration available, which I think is really terrific. The week-long is amazing, but it's hard for some people to get away for that length of time.
Oh, sure.
Yeah.
So anyone who is listening, check out the conference website at ufocongress.com. Everything is there. Information on the film festival, the schedule, which speakers are on which day, so you can decide which days you want to come if you can't do the whole day. Another thing they have on the website, which I think is just so cool, is they have a place where you can actually sign up to share rides. Like if you're coming from Arizona and you want to share a ride with someone else who is, there's a place where you can post that you're willing to give a ride or that you're looking for one.
I think that's a great idea.
That's a nice feature.
And for those of you listeners that attend UFO conferences, of course, this is one you should mark on your calendar. But if you've never been to a UFO conference in your life and have a certain amount of concern or anxiety about doing so, this is a terrific one to start with. And may I say, as they go into their 19th annual International UFO Congress, it is also one of the finest organized conferences I've ever worked.
Yeah.
It really is. It's wonderful.
It's hard to run these things. So you've got hundreds and hundreds of people there that you try to keep everyone happy.
Yeah.
But they
the logistics
of
getting your speakers in and out is mind-boggling, and the Browns have done it brilliantly for years. Their volunteer team, too, and their team is amazingly professional. I actually stayed an extra day last year to help strike the set, and I was really humbled by the amount of work that it reflected that went into setting it up, organizing, and then just striking it and putting everything into storage for a year.
Did you say that Dakota had to carry you around that whole last year?
I think that remember.
Yeah, I just didn't help out with that this year. So
drinking rather heavily, so I don't remember that part too well.
Well, we only have a couple minutes left, gentlemen. But Peter, you had some. There was another conference that I wanted to ask you about. The paranormal conference in Florida.
Yes, right now. That seems to be somewhat up in the air, which is why I haven't gotten back to you on it. This is a first effort. You guys will be hearing more about it directly from the organizer within the next few days. I am hoping it's on. If not, it will definitely be rescheduled for later in the year. So, as they say, stay tuned to the station for further developments.
Okay.
Great.
And other than that, I'm delighted that we will all be getting together next weekend here in Ithaca.
Yes.
Yeah, very cool.
That will be a blast. And that's on that project that we mentioned in the first hour that we
can't talk about now.
And
listeners, I am looking forward to having Rich and Karen visit for years, in part to show off my library, my UFO library. And now, not so much.
So you two are going to get together and discuss which is bigger? Is this what I have to...
No, Rich's is bigger, and I'm not happy about it.
I think I'm not going to go there.
What a high-minded note to end this two-hour period on.
Cool. Well, have a great time. I know it'll be awesome.
Yeah.
Gentlemen,
looking forward to it
so much
in the next few days.
Thank you for joining me, and our timing has worked out just about perfectly. The ladies who come behind me, who come in the next show, are breathing a sigh of relief because I'm actually not running into their time for once. So thank you so much, Peter, for joining us on Through the Keyhole. It has been an absolute pleasure.
Always enjoyable.
And thank you, Rich.
My pleasure. Indeed.
I'm upstairs and you're downstairs. It's sort of weird doing this, but actually I haven't talked to you so much in weeks. So
how about you?
Good reason to have a radio show.
No kidding. I get to talk to my husband. And
right.
I want to thank everyone who joined us tonight. Thanks for listening. This has been Through the Keyhole live on the Paranormal Radio Network and on UPRN 105.3 FM in New Orleans. Archives are now available at paranormalradionetwork.org, on iTunes, and also at blackgaultradio.com. Once again, I'm your host, Karen Dolan. Thanks again to my guests, and stay tuned for Portal coming up next with Tuesday Miles and Angela Thomas. Thanks again. See you next week.